Thanks, Luby, for joining me today. And as I'm just sort of sensing in where to begin, I'm remembering maybe the last time we had a face-to-face conversation. And if it wasn't the last time, it's one of the last times. And it was just before you left Wales, where you were moving. And I remember us talking about that, and I remember us talking about our children and our families and moving and how all of those things might be impacted. And I just wondered if you wanted to start with a description of really after sowing those seeds of the plan to move, of how things have unfolded for you in the last 7, 8 years, however long you've been in your place now. And maybe specifically to ask about the growth of that, you know, so thinking about it through that metaphor of growing and life emerging.
Well, yeah, it has been quite an adventure actually. 10 years ago this year that I will have left Wales, and we didn't immediately move to the place I'm in now, which is Applewood Permaculture Centre. So we had 3 moves in between, which were quite exhausting, but we've managed to really find our dream place. And we run courses here, and we've got 20 acres here. And to carry on that sort of plant metaphor, it really felt before we moved here that I was a plant, a bit root bound in a pot, being moved around, but I wanted to be in the ground. And moving here and having this stable home and this connection with all the beings that share this magical home of 20 acres with us, it is like being in the ground, and my roots are growing, and then the growth below ground is being mirrored by the growth above ground as well, so that I really feel that stability and that of the roots that allows me to come out into the world and be present in the world. And in such a more profound way than I realized was possible, actually. I had a sort of sense of it, but only a sense of some of it. And now that I'm here, I really feel all of it, and there's still plenty of growth to go, I'm sure, because we've been at Applewood Permaculture Centre now for 5 years, so half a decade. Just this week actually is our anniversary of being here, so it's been quite a journey, and quite a rewarding, nourishing journey as well.
Yeah, I am always amazed. It's like I always forget how nature is always mirroring our experience when we step outside of, I mean, I could say my house, but I really mean my own conditioned thinking, really, when I step outside of that and I can find myself reflected in nature. And I wonder if you could talk about, like, how is it in your experience to feel rooted? What is different for you in your day to day, or how you think about yourself, or how you relate to other people, you know, so the specifics of what that is as a human experience to feel rooted and in the ground.
I'm not sure I can put words to it. It is like an embodied sense, and it is a sense of more than me. That more than me that I'm sharing in every interaction, particularly when people come here, but I carry it with me as I move out. And so, and interact with people outside, that bigger picture, that bigger sense of being part of a more than human community is carried with me in a way that I can't put words on or can't put even find that feeling. But I, yeah, your question has maybe invited me to bring more awareness to that in my future interactions. Thank you.
And I don't even know if there are answers to some of the questions that might emerge. And for me,
Yes.
that's always interesting, you know, as we begin to come to experiences that are really difficult to language. And for me, in my practice, when I come into my body, you know, it's slow work trying to find the words of the specifics of my experience of what I'm sensing is it's slow. It's not as fast as my mind would like to work and work things out. So I really appreciate the kind of spaciousness that can come with it. And as I hear you describing the when you're with people in your place, it's more than just you. And when you leave, it's more than just you. It reminds me of the old Celtic tradition of the sacred marriage, of marrying the land, of having this intimate, deep, committed relationship with the land and all of the beings that are part of that. It's a kind of intimacy and connection. And I wonder if you could say more about what that feels like to be intimately connected to this place where you live and maybe it extends beyond there.
I feel like a guest and a visitor, not so much in that I don't belong here, because I do feel like I belong here. And I feel like many of the beings that have been here, that are here, have been here for a lot longer than me, trees generations and generations before. And so I'm here as part of that. I wouldn't even say I'm here as like stewarding it or guardianshipping it. That still feels kind of in some way that I'm above. And actually, I'm just in a deep state of awe and wonder at the life and the ecosystems and all that happens here without me, with me observing, with me here, but in a light touch. So not being a human that comes in and is like, this is how I want things, but to be here as observing and witnessing and being with the trees and the buzzards and the ravens and the bats and the badgers and the dragonflies and all the amazing beings that are here. And have maybe been here for generations or generations of them. So, fledglings after fledglings that have been here. And yeah, so just really being humble in the beingness of that, in the, yeah.
Was there a time in your life where you had a different way of relating to the place, nature, where you didn't perceive all of that or acknowledge all of that or were in a different kind of relationship with?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I grew up in like a suburb of London, so we had a common where Wimbledon Common, where we used to walk, and so that was the wild space. And we were lucky enough to have a garden with a big mulberry tree that I would climb on. So I was connected with that tree. But beyond that, nature was really just, this wall of green that people describe it, that, if you don't know any plant names or tree names, it's just a wall of green. You maybe can differentiate some shades of green in there, but maybe not. Maybe it is just a wall of green and or carpet of green. So I was very much like that as growing up, and didn't, but my awareness and how I interact with the plant world and the more than human world has grown over the time, over the last 2 decades, since I've been connected with permaculture and gardening and being with the land. Then it's grown from that. And maybe I wasn't too conditioned to be, kind of dominating the land, as well as not being conditioned to respect it and look after it. It was just kind of like not there, which I think is the case for a lot of people. There is the spectrum there, from the whole dominating, where the land is here just to be a place for humans to do what they want to do and for it to serve us, to the other end of the spectrum where it's full respect for the land and all the beings are kin, and we need to be part of the web, but not, we're not the weavers of the web. And then there's a kind of middle ground, which I think actually a lot of us are in, where it's just kind of invisible to us, and it's neither here nor there. It's ignored in our education, in our relationships, in our growing up, in the valuing of it. It's just ignored, not part of that, if you're growing up in a city, particularly.
Were there any moments, that you can remember where that came alive to you in a way that, surprised or shocked or brought wonder, where you realized nature is animate, it's alive, in a way that was outside of your comprehension or awareness before?
I mean, the first time I grew a crop, which was spinach, it was out on a patio in Brighton. It was like concrete, and there was a little square of earth that I could grow something in. And it was my first experience of like going from seed to plant to eating. We had, I think my mum had done a little bit in as growing up, but I hadn't really paid attention to that. And so that was really like, wow, this is like magic, like, what? You just put these seeds in the ground and then they turn into seedlings, and then they turn into plants, and then you can eat them, and then they grow bigger, and it's like, wow. So that was, that was quite amazing. And I think, yeah. And I mean, my whole experience when I moved to Brighton, and we're just outside of town and at the university, and seeing cows from the window was just like, whoa, this is, amazing. Yeah, so it was that experience grew. So I can't put my finger on at the moment a particular moment. Those two stood out, sort of that, but yeah, it was something. I think that when people allow themselves to be in the more than human world, it works its magic on a below conscious level. And so often it can do it on a sort of subtle creeping up kind of way. Sometimes it is that those like lightning bolt experiences, and it's like, wow, this is the moment where I suddenly realize we're all connected, and the magic and energy of the more than human world. But sometimes it's just a subtle growing there that's shifting under the surface.
I've got two or three points now that I'm like, oh, this, let's go here, let's go here. I mean, I think what I'll reflect on that and then take us down another path and not go into this. But it reminds me when I hear you talking about them allowing the magic. I mean, one, I hear that we have to stop sort of stopping ourselves, really, to allow means that, we're actually stopping something from being in connection there. And I think that connection is internal as much as it is external, in my experience. And that when we allow one, the other also happens. So the more we connect with nature, the more we connect with ourselves, and that there's a kind of reciprocity there. And when I hear you saying the magic, it reminds me of some of the conversations I hear about the enchantment, of nature. And the sort of myths and the stories and the legends, as well as the direct contact in terms of the plants and the other beings that we might engage or encounter in these places. And I'm really curious about this word magic and enchantment that's used. And I guess where I go to in my imagination is really the sense of agency that can be in the other than human world. So I think of fairies, straight away. And in the Irish tradition, like the world of fairies, I think there's a great saying of, some old guy from west of Ireland going, whether you believe in them or not, doesn't make a matter of a difference to them. They still are there. It's not a question of belief, but a sense that these other beings, visible or invisible, also have a kind of, I mean, I'm going to say force because that's the theme of the podcast, but a kind of presence that, again, we may sense or we don't sense, but is still weaving there. And the idea of enchantment, for me, I suppose I feel there's a, it's not a negative connotation, but to be enchanted means somebody has put a spell on you, really. That's what enchantment is. And so I when I hear people talking about, oh, the enchantment of the land, it's like, well, what are we actually saying? Is it that feeling when I go to the Bluebell Woods and I don't want to leave and it's a mystery? I don't know why, but I feel, heavy and sort of sensual. And, in certain places, there is this, I feel it in my body that I feel changed in that place. So a kind of a power of certain places, and I don't know what that is. But yeah, so there's something about that enchantment that I'm really curious about, that word of enchantment, magic, and how we use it.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many cultural connotations around that word, aren't there? And magic and witches and the whole, witch burnings that happened when women were in touch with plants that had uses, had medicinal uses, could work their magic, work their power unseen. And so yes, those words, the words magic and enchantment, have cultural connotations. And enchantment, that has that connotations of the feminine magic and the putting you under the feminine spell there. And so there's so much cultural connotations around that, isn't there? And there's so much cultural connotations around how we interact with the land. And many people are really unaware that we have been culturally conditioned into how we view, how we perceive, how we interact, how we experience, how we talk about the more than human world. Is it the environment? Is it the ecosystem? Is it the land? Is it property? You know, what is it that, and we do that, how, where are the, you know, the cultural phobias around and dis and aversions to particular species that we have? What do we think is acceptable to do to the land? We've been culturally conditioned so much around that, and we're unaware that that is how we've been culturally conditioned. And some of it is good. You know, we're in the UK, we are a nation of bird feeders. You know, we spend our money on bird food to feed the birds. Great. You know, that's really good. And a lot of countries that would be, you know, absurd to spend money on food for birds. So there are some, you know, cultural practices which are worthwhile and beneficial, and there's many that aren't, and we don't necessarily question why we're doing one and not the other. Or so that's an interesting inquiry for all of us, of where do we get our beliefs from and our language around how we interact with the world? Where do they all come from? Are they actually what we believe, you know, what we want to be? So when we say the word enchanted, just to go back to that, we are actually enchanted by our cultures. we are put under this magical spell to believe that what we're being told in the media messages, in our education, in our television programs, in all of that, what we're being told is the way of interacting with the world. And that's a powerful spell. needs to be broken. And that's, you know, my work with cultural emergence is to help us to understand our cultural conditioning, and so that we can make choices around that and lead us somewhere different.
Mm. What role does language itself play in that conditioning and that storytelling? And you know, I link the spell to the spelling, because we use words really to create these structures all the time. And where for you does language come in, and how do you use it in different ways, in a sense, to create these new ways of thinking, new ways of being, new ways of living?
I think I like that connection between spell and spelling. I love that. And there is a very cyclical relationship between culture and language. They drive each other, so you can't pull one out and say language drives culture. Yes, that's how it works, because it also works that culture drives language, and then they reinforce each other. So so what was the question again? How do we break it?
Or how do you individually, you know, what, you know, maybe different kind of forms of writing that you explore in your books? I know you write poetry as well as your other books. You know, what forms of writing do you find useful to be able to sort of break that spell of conditioning that we all have, more or less? How do you find ways through it in words?
So one of the activities that I did many, many years ago was to actually start noting down my self-talk of like, oh, I've just said I can't do this, or, you know, or God, that was stupid for me to do that, or indecisiveness, and I realized that I was doing a lot of disaster scenarioing. Oh, you know, my daughter's 5 minutes late, it must mean that the bus has crashed, you know. And it's like, yeah, really. So I was writing them down, and that really helped me to see them, to then transform them, to really start being aware of all the times I was saying, oh, I should do that, or that was stupid, or all of those things, those little subtle messages that I was giving to myself that I wasn't even really aware of, but were draining my energy. And then to really consciously bring in reframes of them, and to really make myself aware that there's a point in that self-talk where I could choose to say something different to myself, and that that choice point would then reinforce itself if I keep doing that, and that it would energize me, and it would release me, and it would give me different options of how to be with myself. And that has then helped me in how I speak to other people as well. But yeah, it's amazing how much goes on in our own heads, that if you were, if you do write it out, you're like, oh, whoa, really? I say that. Say that, and then once it's out, you have that sort of ability to reshape it. So that's I try and pay attention to my own internal dialogue.
One of the things I find really useful that I come across sometimes is, even if people are listening and maybe it might be the first time that they're considering, oh, how do I speak to myself? Is when we find those things, sometimes we can justify them because they're always internalized from some experiences we've had in the culture or family, whatever. Is like, would I speak to a 5-year-old like this? Would I speak to another human being like this? So why can I justify speaking to myself like this? And it feels like when we can begin to break those ways of speaking to ourselves, like my experience of that is I just free up so much space, mental space. And when the mental kind of loosens off, then I'm just so much more connected to my body and to what is here, what is real in a sense, what is really here right now. And like you said, for me, that also changes the way I relate to other people and everything around me.
Yeah, definitely.
I wonder how that how you this what you described there was how words could deplete you of energy, or if you change the words that you're saying to yourself, you feel energized. And I just wonder about your work in the world and what your intention is for that, really, in terms of, and it may or may not be, I suppose it may or may not be linked to anything to do with conditioning. And yet, in a way, what you're introducing people to through your books, through your courses, is another way of being, another way of living, another way of interacting, another way of relating. So I just wondered, what is the sort of driving force, if you like, behind all of that which you bring to the world through your work? What drives you?
Well, I think the main drive is this awareness of this huge, huge capacity each one of us has to be more than we are at the moment, wherever we are in our lives, whatever we've managed to achieve in the last 10, 20 years, or whatever we haven't done. We all have this much bigger potential. And how do we unlock that potential? And it's not necessarily this one key that opens the whole door to our potential. So, 10 years ago, when I started writing and I unlocked that door to, and that the commitment to writing People and Permaculture, my first book, that unlocked a whole lot more. Then you know, moving the finding Applewood, there's always more doors to unlock to our potential, and many of us don't really know how to do that. We might be wanting to do that, we might be have a sense of something on the other side. And so my work through courses, through permaculture, and then moving into and expanding into cultural emergence is around giving us tools so that we can open the door and we can choose to walk through that door and explore and discover things that quite amaze us about ourselves. And you know, one of my big motivations for change is seeing so many, you know, the state of the world, and knowing that we don't need to be there, knowing that actually we have the tools, the techniques to move us beyond there. It's the narrative that we need to adapt that invites us onto that journey of change, and that will help us to move somewhere to a more regenerative future that we all need. Because if we don't do that, we're you know, it's a pretty dire picture. And and I do believe that we can do that. We can, and it starts with all of us finding our agency for change in ourselves, in how we show up in the world. And I know that that isn't always possible. I know that that is kind of easy to say from a place of privilege, and that there are people who don't have the privilege to show up in the world. You know, maybe they would be amazing musicians, but they've got no access to funds to get instruments. You know, that, I mean, that's just a really simple example of the many lacks of privileges that keep us from shining our gifts. And I believe that the more of us that do find ways, the more opportunities and the more pathways we open up for other people as well.
Well, it is a big, you know, to quote Amanda Gorman, it is a big hill we climb. Here we're, in some ways, it is a big hill to climb. It is, you know, the work ahead of us is enormous, because we are dealing with, you know, not just generations, but millennia of patriarchy and, you know, colonialism and racism, sexism, you know, it's all there, isn't it? It's not recent issues that we need to challenge. And at the same time, they are just constructs, and they can be deconstructed. They're not real in themselves in the same way that a tree is real in itself. It's, you know, they are people-made constructs, and they can disappear overnight. I'm sure we've all had that experience at some point where something's been said to us that has just shifted a belief somehow, shifted our understanding in a moment. So it can happen at any time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think back to those first few months of lockdown last year, and, you know, seeing photographs from Delhi looking up to the Himalayas, and, you know, the mountains being visible for the first time in people's lives, and, you know, something that seemed absolutely impossible weeks before, all of a sudden, when the world shifted and everything shifted and everything changed really quickly, there's a this potential for another way of being. And I'm really curious as to how this rupture, in a sense, of the pandemic on everyone's lives in so many different ways, will emerge. Because what I know about ruptures, I mean, I liken it to trauma, really. I mean, trauma comes in as from an experience where something is so overwhelming, we dissociate and we come out of our experience because it's too much for our nervous system to process. And so there's a rupture, but and then it takes a little while to settle back in before we begin to process that, And so I'm really interested to see what will emerge in this next 5 to 10 years now as people individually, really, and then collectively as communities and as nations, and then globally as we begin to process this shift that has happened on such a deep level and will continue to unfold. And
Yeah, I've just I need to go because my daughter's having trouble breathing, so I've just got that message.
Okay.
So
That's fine. I mean, we can leave it at that point. That's totally fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. Thank you, Luby. Go, 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 go.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.